Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The fossil fuel industry is a very risky business, and often these risks materialize. Think of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil eruption, the 2016 oil train derailment in Mosier, Oregon, and the 2017 gas pipeline explosion in Seattle's Greenwood neighborhood. It might seem logical that polluters will be expected to pay for the damage they cause, but that is not always the case. Too often, taxpayers are the ones who foot the bill for an accident because, under current laws, the public cannot count on the industry to cover the financial impacts of fossil fuel pollution or remediation. Today, we talk with Daphne Wisham and John Talberth with the Center for Sustainable Economy about what would happen if fossil fuel companies had to prepay for their risks and future liabilities before they could even operate. Daphne and John, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having us.
Let's talk about how the fossil fuel industry has basically been unaccountable for the damages that they can inflict on communities, and what are some of the remedies that you've been thinking about that might address that?
Yeah, so the economic rationale behind fossil fuel risk bond programs, which is a policy solution to this crisis that state and local governments can adopt, is pretty simple. Every year, the industry externalizes trillions of dollars in economic damages onto the backs of taxpayers. And these costs manifest in the form of climate disasters, fossil fuel infrastructure disasters like oil trains derailing, and the cost of interventions needed to both mitigate and adapt to climate change. So the taxpayers are now forced to handle all these bills. According to the UN's most recent analysis, the cost of achieving climate stability has been priced out anywhere between $1.6 and $3.8 trillion per year and is rising every year we delay bold climate action. And so what can state and local governments and even the federal government do about this situation where all these costs are now on the backs of taxpayers? Well, our idea, and it's beginning to be implemented in Portland, in the city of Portland, in Multnomah County, in King County, Washington, is called a fossil fuel risk bond program. And there's two ways that this program starts to shift the burden of fossil fuel infrastructure back to where it belongs on the polluter. And the first category is called financial assurance mechanisms. And these are simple like things like insurance and letters of credit and third-party trust fund accounts where the fossil fuel industry puts up the money in advance for dealing with things like catastrophes and spills and in the eventuality of going bankrupt, cleaning up their mess that they leave behind. The second category of measures under this program are surcharges put on fossil fuel transactions that are put into a trust fund that is used to pay for the costs of climate change adaptation and climate disasters. So it's a pretty simple concept, and it's already gaining traction in multiple cities across the U.S., including Portland.
Well, I want to back up a little bit and talk about why the fossil fuel industry has been able to get away with all this massive pollution for years and years and years and all over the world. And there seems to have been no recourse. What kind of loophole is there? I mean, if I hire a contractor, he's got to be bonded and licensed. And if he messes up, then he has insurance that's going to pay. But that's not the case with fossil fuel industries. So how has it gotten to that point?
Well, as we know, the fossil fuel industry is getting all kinds of subsidies. Some are more transparent than others. Taxpayer subsidies, reduced royalties to the federal government in exchange for drilling on public land. And what we've discovered is that there's actually this other hidden subsidy that virtually no jurisdiction in the U.S. and perhaps globally has accounted for, which is the extraordinary risk that is now being externalized on both on frontline communities and on the taxpayer in the event of, a catastrophic accident like what we saw in Lac Mégantic in Canada. That accident cost roughly $2 billion when a train, the brakes failed and it collided in a town and vaporized over 40 people in the town of Lac Mégantic. That cost about $2 billion. Well, what happened? It's very predictable. They declare bankruptcy. And then it's the taxpayer that foots the tab. So knowing that this pattern is predictable, and knowing that what we have here in Portland is all of our critical energy infrastructure, the so-called CEI hub, is located on the banks of the Willamette River in an earthquake subduction zone on landfill that will liquefy, that will turn to jelly when, not if, we get the next major quake. We're anticipating it could be as big as a 9.0, and we're overdue for a major quake. The state has done nothing to ensure that this industry secures its infrastructure, and the industry has no incentive right now. Essentially, why would they, if they know that they can call it an act of God when the earthquake hits, and then offload all of those liabilities on the public sector by declaring bankruptcy? So we know this quake is coming. And when we met with the Multnomah County Commission and with the City Council, they were very excited by the innovative approach that we were taking. And you can learn more about, you know, sort of the aspects of the risk bond, you know, that it draws on existing laws in our report, which is up on our website at sustainable-economy.org. But now that they've engaged an economist who is going to be assessing the cost of the risk that's now externalized on the public sector, and once they've assessed that risk, the next step is to basically turn that payment back over to the polluter and say, you've got to post that, the cost of that risk up front as a condition of continued operation in the city of Portland and the county of Multnomah. Otherwise, we're going to have to begin a conversation around a just transition, and ideally do that before the big one comes.
Well, I'm thinking, as the city right now is under siege by federal agents, and we're looking at how difficult it is to really push back against some really strong forces, that when you're talking about getting the fossil fuel industry to pay for all the damage that they've done globally as well as locally, you've got a very long history to push back against. And I'm thinking particularly about the Superfund Act back, I think, started in the 70s. And in the beginning, it was the polluters who had to pay into the Superfund site. But I think under George W. Bush, that all changed. And the Superfund Fund is probably bankrupt at this point. And I know that with dealing with the Portland Superfund site, that it's the polluters have been really pushing back about having to pay their fair share. So how do you change the mentality so that we get polluters, whether it's fossil fuel polluters or whether it's the schnitzers who, you know, have their metal recycling business, which is very polluting. How do we get them to do the right thing and to do the necessary thing to protect our communities?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the reason we have super funds is because nobody thought to kind of model out the worst case scenarios ahead of time and collect the money up front before any permitting started. And so that's the beauty of these fossil fuel risk bond programs, is that before any new facility is permitted, any new pipeline goes in, any new export facility goes in, there has to be a thorough science-based analysis of what the worst case scenario is in terms of infrastructure abandonment, in terms of accidents, and that money needs to be put aside before the construction and operation of the facility, not after. And so that's kind of a powerful incentive to kind of, you know, call it a Superfund 2.0, where in fact, this time around, we get it right and we collect the money ahead of time before anything new is put in. And that will provide a pretty major deterrent, we think, to any company coming in here on a whim, thinking they're going to extract the level of profits that they're accustomed to from Portland or Multnomah County or Seattle or wherever we're getting these going. They're going to have to think twice, because they're going to have to put up the money for cleaning up their mess and dealing with catastrophes before they happen.
Well, I'm thinking about the projects that are on the drawing board right now, in particular Jordan Cove LNG export terminal down in Coos Bay and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline, which could wreak incredible damage on that whole region of the state. And people keep pushing back against these projects, talking about the costs and the damage and the lack of accountability. So I'm wondering how your proposals would affect these projects that are in place right now. I mean, they haven't been fully permitted. And in fact, I understand just the other day that Jordan Cove had another setback because the State Land Use Board of Appeals denied a permit that had been given to them by the North Bend City Council to go ahead with some dredging. If in some way, actually, that Jordan Cove got all the permits it needs, what would happen then? What would you be able to do through risk bonds to then maybe stop it at that point?
Well, fortunately, counties have the authority, irrespective of what FERC says, irrespective of the state permitting, to move forward and require that for the pipeline, the segments of the pipeline that go through their counties, they have the ability to impose a risk bond on those pipelines to cover the worst case scenario of, say, a major pipeline rupture and fire in a really bad time of year for fires. Like right now, if a big fire broke out and we had the right conditions, there'd be a catastrophic wildfire. That's totally within the purview of the county to impose a risk bond to have that money put up front. And so we think it's like kind of a third line of defense against these projects. We've got people battling at the federal level. We have people battling at the state level, but there is a battle to be had at the county level through this risk bond program. And so it's very much an option that these counties down south can use to further insulate themselves from the costs that are being passed on by this proposal.
Well, another case in point that's very disturbing is this proposed LNG facility in Tacoma, where, again, they are totally underinsured. I mean, it's a ridiculously low amount that Puget Sound Energy is insured for. And it doesn't seem that any county or city officials in Pierce County or Tacoma are really holding their feet to the fire. So is there any way for activists to be able to make use of this mechanism that you're talking about to try to get their communities on board?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, King County, Washington is going to be voting next week, I believe, on whether or not to explore the imposition of a risk bond at the county level. But there's a lot that could actually be done at the state level. As you know, you mentioned COVID, and of course, the current state of the fossil fuel industry is extremely dire because of the COVID crisis, because people aren't flying as much as they used to. And that has created unprecedented financial risks to public budgets and health risks to frontline communities that now require urgent preemptive action. I don't know if you saw the New York Times article recently where they were talking about how with the fossil fuel industry on the brink of bankruptcy, made more so by the sudden and dramatic drop in consumption of fossil fuels as people curtail their travels and shelter in place around the globe. Something like 40% of oil and natural gas producers face insolvency within the year if crude oil prices remain near $30 a barrel. So one thing that we have been exploring is to sort of take the fossil fuel risk bonds concept and accelerate it at the state level with an executive order issued perhaps by the governor of Washington or the governor of Oregon saying, you have X number of days, fossil fuel industry, to provide us with access to your bank accounts to make sure that you're actually solvent enough to clean up whatever mess you leave behind, or we need to begin the process of thinking through a transition so that it's not left to the taxpayer to pick up the tab. This is enshrined in international law. The concept of polluter pays is actually something that the international community has agreed is a logical way to handle pollution. But too often what we see is the bigger the oil and gas companies are, the more they can wriggle out of any responsibility. And now what we're seeing is with more and more of them going bankrupt, we're going to have a tsunami of, there's going to be an oncoming tsunami of debt defaults, contingent liabilities, and catastrophic risks that are going to be externalized on the taxpayer. We should not be paying for that.
And one thing, Barbara, that, you know, message to activists in some of these conservative counties where, you know, the county might be wanting to go full speed ahead and getting a new facility in, but they all, even the most conservative county commissioners, supervisors, have to pay attention to their budgets. And if they understand that permitting a new facility is going to end up costing the county perhaps tens of millions, hundreds of millions, whatever, and that is the put on the table and put, you know, activists making that very clear that they don't want to be part of this county's fiscal suicide, licensing another facility that's going to cost the county $100 million. That money will have to come out of schools and social services. That's a very powerful organizing strategy to make these costs known, make them known to the most conservative fiscal budget hawks on these commissions. And it, you know, and then one thing leads to another, and pretty soon we're back having support, widespread support, like we had in Multnomah County for a resolution like this.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Daphne Rosham and John Talberth with the Center for Sustainable Economy about what would happen if fossil fuel companies had to prepay for their risks and future liabilities before they could even operate. Last year, when Zenith rolled into town with their oil trains, people were really alarmed to discover that there seemed to be no way to stop them from increasing the number of oil trains they're going to put through Portland through the expansion of their terminal. And I went to a meeting back in, I think it was the spring of 2019, where people were trying to come up with creative suggestions. And Sharon Myron, who's a county commissioner, at that time talked about that the county was looking into risk bonds that would perhaps have an impact on that kind of development. How far along were you in the process of talking to the county and the city about risk bonds when that meeting happened?
Yeah, we were pretty far along because we've been talking to them probably for the last three and a half years, both the city and the county. And the scope of fossil fuel infrastructure in the city, it's not only the critical energy hub and the storage tanks there, but it's the oil trains, the increasing number of gas hookups everywhere, the increasing amount of liquid fuels being transported on the rolls. So it's kind of like an out of control situation in growth in fossil fuel infrastructure. And so we've been exploring ways that a resolution could be put in place, and an ordinance put in place in the city itself, in the county, or in some, even metro-wide. So these discussions have been going on for quite a while. And then, of course, on top of that, you have the overlay of the catastrophic earthquake, the 9.0, and what that would do to the critical energy hub. And the information started coming out about the fact that if an oil spill happened and our worst case scenario is there, it could be the largest oil spill on Earth. And so this really lit a fire under decision makers, Commissioner Myron and others, to really start exploring this more carefully. And that's where I think we were able to get in front of the decision makers, make presentations, walk through how the program would be implemented. And that's all been quite successful. And the momentum is still going on.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what that area is like, because there's a lot of Portlanders who've never been down to the port and really don't even think about it. You might drive down Highway 30 on your way to Soviet Island, and you may notice there's a lot of tanks there. You might not think about what they are. But let's describe what is down there and just how dangerous it is.
Well, it's basically the jet fuel for the entire state of Oregon. And it's 90% of the oil for transportation fuels for Oregon, and it also includes propane and LNG and other chemicals that are used in various industrial processes.
Now, how would having risk bonds, would that have any impact on what's being stored there? Because this is already pre-existing infrastructure. It's not even included in the future fossil fuel infrastructure ban that Portland passed several years ago.
Yeah, I mean, fossil fuel risk bond programs would certainly affect what is being shipped there and what's being stored, because the more dangerous it is, the higher the cost it is going to be for any company involved to put up the required bonding. So if you're shipping risky fuels and things that cause like major health effects, the bonding is going to be a lot higher than if you're shipping something more innocuous.
Well, what I'm kind of curious about, because one of the things that I think most Portlanders don't realize is that we store all the fuel for the entire state of Oregon. And I have some friends who live in Tacoma, and they were coming down to visit me last year and were on the train, and they went past the port, and they were amazed because they saw that there were more oil and fossil fuel storage facilities in Portland than there are in the port of Tacoma. And Tacoma is very notorious for being a very dangerous place, but Portland isn't. So part of the issue is that some of the fuel that's stored there is actually necessary to run the state. So I'm wondering how you would sort out who gets charged, who has to carry the bonds, if it's everybody, and how that impacts the economy of the entire state of Oregon.
Well, that's a really good question, because in many ways, Portland is taking all the risk for the entire state's energy supply. And the fact that this is all built on an earthquake subduction zone means that the entire state is potentially at risk of losing access to all of that fuel in the event of a catastrophic quake. So not only does this mean that Portland is shouldering an unfair burden, but it also is an enormous risk to the entire state of Oregon to continue along those lines. So essentially what we're doing is we're forcing a conversation that needs to be had regardless due to the seismic risk, but also due to the climate risk. We need to begin a process of a just transition away from these fossil fuels. Climate science tells us we have less than a decade, and we need to begin the process of reducing our emissions by at least 7.6% on average per year just to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. So we have two very critical deadlines to face, one of which we don't know when it's going to come, which is the next big one, and the other is the climate risk. And if we can do this in an orderly fashion, we can also be pushing the entire state in the right direction towards all electric vehicles, towards public transit, towards a cleaner economy that we know will be better for all of us. And especially in the age of COVID, I mean, I think what you're seeing is the intersection between race, disease, exposure to pollutants that come from fossil fuels. And then, of course, you have the knock-on effect of a lot of these industries now declaring bankruptcy. It's clear that this is a very volatile industry that is both unhealthy for all of us, as well as unhealthy for the climate.
And it also raises the question of, is it wise in the era of global warming and in our inevitable transition away from fossil fuels, is to continue to have centralized big energy facilities? I think that paradigm has come and gone, and the future is going to look a lot more like decentralized renewable facilities. One goes down someplace else, we can help substitute in the energy from somewhere else. You don't put all your eggs, especially your toxic eggs, in one basket in this kind of new energy transition that we need. So we're really happy that there's a lot of focus on the CEI hub, not only in terms of the risks to Portland and surrounding areas, but in terms of just, does this make sense anymore to have these large centralized facilities when we in fact need to move towards a more dispersed, diversified, and decentralized system?
So do you think that having these risk bonds that these companies would have to pay up front might incentivize them or somebody to replace them that's not going to be storing LNG or natural gas or oil or fuel or whatever is being stored in these tanks, or tar sands oil right now is being stored at Zenith, that it was incentivized instead for a replacement of that, of being renewables? And I wonder how you see that kind of transition happening, and how easily do you think it's going to be to push the fossil fuel industry into the past?
There's two legs of the fossil fuel risk bond program. There's two different pathways, and one is the financial assurance mechanisms. The other is a surcharge-based trust fund that's going to be capitalized by a charge on every gallon of jet fuel or diesel or being moved around in the economy. That fund, that, and we're calling it the fossil fuel risk trust fund, will be capitalized by these surcharges. It can be used then to start jump-starting the transition, to start paying for not only cleaning up the toxic infrastructure, but investing in the next generation of energy infrastructure. So it's really important that in addition to just having these insurance mechanisms and bonding requirements, we start charging the fossil fuel industry what it's going to cost us to make the transition, put that money in a trust fund account, and it's part of our overall climate adaptation agenda for the state, to start investing in these renewable alternatives.
I'm just wondering about what kind of pushback you're getting from the fossil fuel industry. I had this memory at a hearing in City Hall several years ago around the fossil fuel infrastructure ban discussion, that there, at that point, the city was proposing that the fossil fuel industry could increase their storage facilities by, I don't remember if it was 10% or whatever, and in exchange for doing seismic upgrades. And somebody from Kinder Morgan got up. First of all, he talked about how he felt like he was at a barbecue and he was the meat. And he goes on to say that 10% is not enough and that it's not worth their while to do the seismic upgrades unless they got at least 25% expansion. At which point, I remember Amanda Fritz saying, "So you're saying 10% is not enough?" And he's saying yes. And she says, "Well, then maybe we shouldn't do any at all." And then, of course, all the students from Sunnyside Environmental School were cheering. That, to me, is an indication of just how much pushback there is. So are you aware at all of what the positions of the fossil fuel industry are about this?
Well, I think that's a losing battle they're fighting to try to claim that they're going to need to expand their capacity in the future, because the entire world is going down the road of reducing demand for their products. And we haven't even scratched the surface of the efficiency improvements, the conservation improvements. We could easily cut demand for fossil fuels down by 50% or more without any deleterious effects on, people's economic well-being. I'm convinced of that. There's many researchers across the world that are convinced of that. There's so much waste in the system. We shouldn't be planning for any increase in capacity at all, whether it's gas or oil or jet fuel or liquid LNG. So it's just kind of it's a losing argument for them to be arguing this. We need extra capacity.
Well, it might be a losing argument, but they're still making it. And I'm just wondering what kind of political clout they have to put the brakes on the city and the county actually taking any meaningful steps to start imposing risk bonds on their future development.
The clause that they tend to rely on is the Interstate Commerce Clause, claiming that this would be a barrier to interstate commerce. And we are not saying you cannot do business in the city of Portland. We're actually saying we just want you to actually pay for the risks that are now being externalized on the taxpayer and on the frontline communities. And, that's a tough argument to make on behalf of one of the largest industries in the world, that somehow frontline communities should be taking on this risk and they shouldn't. So I think we've got both the facts and the figures and the politicians behind us. And we also know that this is a dying industry, and we need to clean it up before it pulls up and leaves town and leaves a huge mess, so that we don't have another Superfund site on top of the existing one.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Daphne Wysham and John Talberth with the Center for a Sustainable Economy about what would happen if fossil fuel companies had to prepay for their risks and future liabilities before they even operate. Well, before we get into the business that I think has stirred up a lot of people's awareness of the need for this, which is Zenith Energy, I just wanted to talk a bit more about the recalcitrance of the fossil fuel industry, because I'm thinking about places all around the world. I'm thinking about Ecuador, where Texaco, now owned by Chevron, did incredible pollution and did never cleaned it up. And there was a big lawsuit. It was an international lawsuit. The Ecuadorian Supreme Court held up this massive fine that Chevron had to pay, and then it was overturned by some court mechanism in the United States. So I'm just thinking about all the different layers that you have to deal with that are going to be coming at you and saying, no, we can't do this. It's really bad for the economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, just thinking it's bad for the economy is the fact that every ton of greenhouse gas pollution right now is imposing a cost on all of us of about $417, right? That's the current best estimate of the social cost of carbon, kind of a median value. So the economics are, this massive externality of trillions and trillions of dollars a year imposed on taxpayers and the global economy from climate change versus their bottom dollar. I don't think, it doesn't even come close. So that's the kind of the broader economics at work. And in terms of, the economy is no longer dependent on fossil fuels either. We're making so many strides in so many parts of the world away from fossil fuels and demonstrating that an economy can thrive that's 100% renewable energy, or is based on local renewable supplies, or just minimizing, not maximizing fossil fuel consumption. All those economic arguments they've been using, that fossil fuels are in fact the fuel of the global economy, they're no longer valid, right? There's more jobs, more investment, and more economic prosperity being generated by the transition than has ever been generated by the fossil fuel industry.
And the renewable industry is actually competitive, if not cheaper, than fossil fuels. We're seeing that right now in the EU, where renewables are providing the same amount of energy for less cost.
Well, I'm curious about the kind of political support you have for doing these responses. Besides Sharon Merrim, was there anybody else on the county commission that was open to this idea and started to investigate it?
Yeah, Commissioner Jayapal was very receptive and open to working on this. Of course, her district, District 2, is right across the river and also is at risk in the event of a major industrial accident in that region. But ultimately, we had unanimous support from the entire county commission, and then we got unanimous support from the city council as well.
So the city took the county lead, as they've often done, actually. There's been one threat after another here in the Northwest around fossil fuels, and the biggest one to date that was a disaster was the Mosier train explosion in 2016. But before that, what was really the threat was this proposed North America's largest oil-by-train terminal that was proposed for Vancouver, Washington, which would have brought, I don't remember how many mile-long unit oil trains through the region several times a week. So county governments and city governments up and down the Columbia River were in opposition to the oil train terminal, which was defeated finally just a couple years ago. I'm wondering how much that active engagement in trying to stop oil trains fed into interest in taking the next step to prevent them, which would be this risk bond, and how you approach the city and the county governments to get them interested in this.
Well, essentially what you have with oil trains, like the oil train derailment in Mosier, it's a different set of actors than you would have in an oil terminal. The railways, as I'm sure you're aware, are very difficult, if not impossible, to regulate from a state or local level, whereas terminals, which are fixed in a jurisdiction, and within that jurisdiction, local elected officials have constitutionally protected authority under the police powers to protect the health and safety of their constituents. So we have yet to experiment with how to use the risk bonds in terms of, for example, communities that are at risk by the oil trains going through their communities. That's a test case that we have yet to test. We're primarily focused on the terminals right now.
But that's not by choice. It's more of a political decision right now to put off dealing with oil trains for now. We still think there's an easy way forward that the county and the city should be working aggressively to figure out how to require oil trains passing through a particular area to put up a bond for a catastrophic risk of an accident. And maybe this only makes sense for urban areas where there's no businesses and in urban infrastructure in the way. But still, the county and the city both realize this is an issue that hasn't been dealt with. We've been given some assurances that they're going to get into that, maybe in phase two, but we're not going to be letting up on them, because we think this is a really important issue. And yes, there's complicated issues over interstate commerce and the rights of railroads, but we believe there's a way forward, and we're going to continue to make the case for that.
I also just want to add that in King County, they don't have any terminals to speak of in King County. As you mentioned, most of them are in Tacoma. But they are interested in taking an innovative approach with risk bonding as it relates to fossil fuel infrastructure more broadly, like gas lines going through communities. So as we experiment in different jurisdictions, there may be different emphases. Rather than on terminals, they want to focus on gas lines. Maybe somewhere else they'd want to focus on pipelines. Somewhere else they want to focus on rail lines. There is a lot of political interest. We have, in fact, just today we heard from Senator Merkley's office. He may be interested. We know that Bernie Sanders made this part of his Green New Deal back when he was running for president. Elizabeth Warren also pledged to make it part of her executive orders if she was elected president. We have the state lands commissioner from New Mexico, public lands commissioner, who's just outraged at all of the costs that are being left behind on public lands by frackers. We've spoken to her, and she's very intrigued. Folks in LA, folks in the Bay Area. So what we're doing is we're incubating something here that could take off in innovative and interesting ways elsewhere. We think it's about time that we have this conversation with the oil and gas industry on the brink of bankruptcy, left and right. We need to do this to protect the public sector and to protect the public good.
Well, you mentioned the Interstate Commerce Act, which is kind of this boogeyman that keeps rising, and it's become actually one of the cornerstones of the Trump administration's defense of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal, because they are testing right now the waters of overriding Oregon's denial of permits for clean water. Their argument is that the Interstate Commerce Act supersedes state law. So I wonder, is that something else that you're taking into consideration?
Well, maybe it supersedes state law in their analysis, but it doesn't supersede our constitutional protections and the constitutional division of power between the federal government and state governments and local governments. State governments and local governments clearly have the authority to put in place programs like the Fossil Fuel Respond programs if they're tiered towards protecting public health, safety, and welfare. That's like a constitutional basis for state and local laws that may conflict with federal laws in some ways, but it's clear that the power does reside with the people and their elected officials at the state and local level to protect themselves against these safety and health risks. And so we're confident that as these risk bond programs go forward, and if they're grounded in the proper documentation that it's about public health concerns, safety concerns, we're confident that they'll be upheld.
Well, I kind of want to put this conversation in the context of what's going on right now in Portland, because we are really under siege by the feds. And it seems like the Constitution's being torn up every night in front of the federal courthouse and the federal building here in Portland. So do you have like a plan B as far as sort of sustaining the cloud of the Constitution while you're trying to put through this proposal that is actually going to fly in the face of a lot of industries and businesses that I think thought that they superseded the Constitution as well?
Well, for a while there, we didn't have the courts, we didn't have the presidency, and we didn't have Congress. Things are changing. We've got one house in Congress where people are now rational and actually listening to the people and enacting sensible measures. Hopefully in a few months, we'll have a new president. Just in the meantime, yeah, things are under siege right now. The Constitution's being ripped up, but the courts are now coming around as well. And so we think that it's the one branch of government that has actually stepped up to the plate to put, to provide a bulwark against Trump's abuses. And we're confident that if this matter of the risk bonds ends up in court, that we'll be able to prevail.
Well, I want to talk some more about the details of how this risk bond would work. You've sort of given a general outline. I'm particularly interested in this fund that would be what you call the Superfund 2.0. But how is it determined to begin with? Who is going to be paying the risk bonds and what are they going to be paying them for?
Yeah, so individual owners of fossil fuel infrastructure, whether you own a storage tank or a gas pipeline or a fleet of gasoline trucks, would need to take out financial assurance mechanisms that would provide the money to guard against any public money that would have to be spent cleaning up their messes in any way, shape, or form, dealing with catastrophic accidents or spills or infrastructure that's abandoned. And so each individual infrastructure owner would have to go through a process to determine what the worst case scenario of the risks are. So for instance, Northwest Natural, right, owns lots of big gas pipelines around the region. They would have to do an assessment, and the city or the county would help them do it, to say what's the worst case scenario of a rupture and explosion of your pipelines in this general area. That would so there'd be a cost estimate associated with that, and a bonding would come would be required to cover that cost. And we could repeat that exercise for every owner of fossil fuel infrastructure. In terms of the trust fund, it would be the city or the county or both would have to come up with an estimate of what they think is going to have to be spent adapting to climate change, dealing with climate disasters such as massive flooding or droughts or wildfires, and then that cost would be the basis for the surcharge to make sure that each year the county, the city, the jurisdiction, the state has enough money on hand to deal with those climate disasters as they unfold. So it wouldn't be some arbitrary assessment of a surcharge. It would actually be based on a cost estimate of what we, the taxpayers, are likely to face over the next 50 years or so in terms of climate change.
And who would be administering that fund?
The fund would be administered by the jurisdiction. So it would be a state or the city or a county.
Now, are you working with communities around the state besides Portland and Multnomah County? I'm particularly thinking of Coos County, Douglas County, Jackson County, Klamath County that are all dealing with Jordan Cove LNG and the Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline.
Well, we've had conversations with folks down there on the path of the pipeline. I think there is a reluctance until we have proof of concept here in Multnomah County and in the city of Portland. Given their capacity to stand up to any kind of legal challenges. But we do have other jurisdictions. Eugene is interested, Columbia County is interested, and there are some jurisdictions up in Washington State as well, and as I mentioned, some in California and elsewhere that are also potentially interested. But I think what Portland has done and does so well is we take innovative concepts, whether it's the No New Fossil Fuel Infrastructure Ordinance that has withstood numerous legal challenges. We incubate them, we've got the legal chops to back them up, and then we set them loose on the world. And we're hoping that the same sort of thing happens here with the fossil fuel risk bonds.
So how far are you along with the Portland plan? Is it still in the concept stage?
Yeah, the Portland plan's being implemented. There's a study. The first step in implementing the risk bond program is to study what all the risks and costs are and put dollar values on those. So there's a RFP that's been out, there's been a contractor selected, and the scope of work is being finalized. So the initial phase one study of what the costs that we're facing here in Portland area on this is actually being commissioned now, and it should be concluded by May or June of next year. And then once that's completed, it'll provide actionable information for the commissioners to reconvene and actually start implementing the risk bond requirements.
And how about on the county level?
Same thing.
Timeline.
So then once the plan is in place, what happens next? I'm just thinking about all those fossil fuel tanks down at the port, and I'm also thinking about Zenith.
Well, you know, the wonderful thing is that there is already a collaborative that is coming together of local communities, frontline communities, artists, Native people, and one of our grassroots organizers, Elijah Cetus, is working closely with them, called the Braided River Collaborative. And they're beginning a conversation around what does come next. And of course, we want to make sure that this is embedded in a jobs program that benefits the frontline communities first, and also, you know, the communities of color, those that are most affected by the toxic effects of this industry. So that's one piece, is the beginning of a conversation that really needs to happen around what a just transition looks like. So that conversation is now underway. It is going to be a community-wide conversation. We want to make sure that we include labor and make sure that community benefits agreements are upheld around whatever transition takes place.
And also, what's great to know, and this is kind of in the works now, is there's going to be a community-based visioning process to what to do with these lands once the toxic infrastructure is removed. And I think that's the most powerful thing that is galvanizing people to move forward with this, is envisioning the next generation of our, you know, port areas, of our waterfront areas. And when this infrastructure is done, what should come next? Should it be a bunch of high-end condos? No, I don't think so. I think this is going to be a community visioning process, parks, open space, affordable housing, community centers. And that's the real exciting stuff I see in the horizon. Once we A, disincentivize any additional construction of fossil fuel infrastructure, B, get the money in place to take down what we have now, then I think this is going to be a real positive process unfolding where people could actually get on the ground and start owning their city, owning the land again, and putting in place plans that are community-based and looking towards the future.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Daphne Weisham and John Talberth with the Center for Sustainable Economy about what would happen if fossil fuel companies had to prepay for their risks and future liabilities before they could even operate. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is, what about Zenith? Because this conversation became much more into the mainstream of the Portland climate movement once we were faced with our own oil train terminal that was expanding at the port at Zenith. So is there any way that these risk bonds could impact what Zenith's current and future development could be?
Yes. You know, one of the things that you asked what lies ahead in the future. The risk bonds, the scope of the risk bonds that is now moving forward in Multnomah County and the city of Portland is narrowly focused on risk to the public sector. There is, of course, the public health risks and the climate risk that have yet to be tallied because we had a limited pool of money to evaluate those risks. I can foresee, especially as we begin to look into climate risks, that terminals like Zenith that are bringing tar sands by rail from the Canadian tar sands region, that those would be paying some of the highest price, not just for the risk to the public sector, but also for the risk to the climate. But in the meantime, I think there are a lot of strategies that are proving quite effective that activists are using. And stay tuned. I think there's going to be some good news coming out pretty soon.
Well, I want to talk a bit more about what's going on in King County. You mentioned that they are also considering having risk bonds, and it would be more, I guess, for preventing things like the big gas explosion that happened in the Greenwood neighborhood a couple of years ago. But I also wonder if it would have any impact on neighboring Pierce County, where most of the fossil fuel infrastructure is. The ports of Tacoma and Seattle are actually one unit, though it seems like the port of Seattle just likes to leave all the dangerous stuff in Tacoma. But on the other hand, the port of Seattle is also trying to expand their cruise ship terminal, which would also increase the amount of LNG that would be there. So I just wonder what you see could be the impact if King County does impose risk bonds like Multnomah County and Portland are probably going to do.
Well, hopefully there'll be some knock-on effects since this stuff is all interrelated to Pierce County as well. And hopefully it'll provide a wake-up call to Pierce County that they really need to follow suit and make this a coherent policy that crosses county boundaries. And so we're definitely working on that front.
But I think, you know, in Pierce County, you have very different politics at play, right? King County is a much more progressive set of elected officials. My understanding of Pierce County is that they're a little more, how shall I say, traditional, and perhaps risk averse in the sense of taking on something like this until they see proof of concept, perhaps, and then perhaps they would.
I've spent a lot of time in Pierce County in the last couple of years, and I see a lot of activists a lot of times banging their head against the wall. I mean, it's very frustrating to see the lack of response. I mean, on the one hand, the Tacoma City Council declared a climate emergency. I think they did it before Portland did. On the other hand, then they increased the ability of the port to expand, and they also are trying to go ahead with this LNG facility that keeps being built, even though for most of the time it was being built, it wasn't permitted. So I think that's a question I have, like, what do we do with communities like Pierce County, or for that matter, Douglas County here in Oregon, where there is a real traditional status quo, basically doing what you've always done because that's the way we know how to do it?
Yeah, I just think getting back to county finances, everybody's aware that state and local governments are strapped for money and they're becoming more strapped for money. And if we just do the hard math to show that these projects don't really pencil out, they in fact leave taxpayers in those counties footing enormous bills at the expense of social services, at the expense of schools, then it actually starts resonating with even the most conservative politicians. And that's, you know, getting to these budget hawks, I think, is the beauty of this program, because we're putting aside the environmental concerns, the climate concerns. We know that those don't resonate. But when it comes to dollars and cents and county budgets, suddenly they wake up. They have to. They really have to wake up and be accountable to the people they represent of not squandering their money. So that's those are the issues that we're getting traction on.
I do want to add to that, because what we've seen with Governor Brown here in Oregon is that she's been willing to issue executive orders on climate. And in Washington State, of course, we've got Governor Inslee, who claims to be a climate champion. There is the potential.
He hasn't issued very many executive orders.
No, but there is the potential for both Governor Brown and Governor Inslee and any other governor to get their attorneys generals to issue and collaboratively issue executive orders or seek legislation declaring, for example, that their state will no longer contract with or allow operations in their jurisdictions any energy company that does not, within a certain number of days, commit to full transparency around all of the debt, including their asset retirement obligations and related bonding and insurance, accountability for and calculating the externalized costs that they're now imposing on the public sector and on frontline communities, and then putting in place bonding and insurance and perhaps even a fee to be leveled on fossil fuel consumption. So these kinds of opportunities are out there. The governors could actually take this on and lead on it.
Well, in a way, I feel like we are quite possibly on the brink of a revolution. Things are moving so quickly and they're becoming so explosive in so many ways and also so divisive. And yet it seems like there's more and more people who are coming to the side of appreciating the interconnection of racism and oppression and climate crisis and all the other things that we're dealing with and police brutality. I wonder how you see what you're talking about fitting into this very explosive time that we're in.
Well, it's kind of encouraging to be operating at this time when, you know, you talk about county finances and those kind of issues, people go to sleep, right? Sometimes, and it's really, you know, our role is a think tank. We work with the decision makers. We make rational decisions. But now it's become, there's so many eyes and ears out listening to what's going on. There's an army of active people who want to make a difference. And once they understand the logic, the economic logic, the racial justice logic of what we're doing, it's now become something that a movement can carry, as opposed to a bunch of wonks working with the decision makers and, you know, doing it behind the scenes. So this has become more of a public movement that this newfound energy in the streets can help fuel, rather than something that will be done at the level of kind of experts talking to decision makers.
What we are fighting against, I don't want to overgeneralize, but is an extractivist sort of colonist economy, right? We know that it's the First Nations people and the Native Americans who, in many ways, are paying the highest price with mining on their lands, with COVID causing all kinds of illness in their communities. We know that in order to flip this model upside down and get to a regenerative economy, we need to restore the land to allow it to draw the carbon out of the atmosphere. We need to preserve our old growth forests. We need to move away from this notion that we can extract indefinitely from the earth for our own greed. And that essentially is a, you know, that's something that I think people that are on the front lines of the fight against police brutality and in favor of Black lives, they understand the prison the school to prison pipeline is very much an extractivist sort of a new twist on slavery, right? I mean, we throw largely black men into jail, and then we extract their labor. And then once they're out on the street again, they can't vote and probably can't get a job and maybe end up back in jail. So there is there are parallels. I don't want to make them too close in line, but there are parallels there. And I think what we need to be thinking about is how do we maintain what we need in the face of the climate crisis and in the face of the economic crisis. We can no longer be living as if there is no tomorrow. and abundant resources that we can just grab anytime we want. We need to be thinking about how we live in harmony with each other and with the environment.
Well, John and Daphne, it's great to talk to you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing, and I want to hear more as it keeps developing. So thanks very much for being on today.
Thank you.
Today, we've been talking with Daphne Wisham and John Talberth with the Center for Sustainable Economy, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you would like to hear what you missed or want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you are able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Dennis White, co-founder of Friends of the White Salmon River, about new pressures that threaten the wild and scenic White Salmon River corridor. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Bag it up. 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 Bag it up.
A person's home should be their castle. When I'm at home, I want to feel like royalty. But I don't want to be the queen of this mess. Never before have I seen such misery. Living with my baby is a hassle. When he's at home, he doesn't care, never combs his hair. Putting him out on the curb unless he cleans his garbage. But my baby loves trash.
My baby leaves his trash all over the house.
I got to dig and dig and dig just to find the bathroom in the morning. My baby loves trash. My baby leaves his trash all over the house. I think it's time to trash my baby.
Bang it up. Bang it up. Bang it up. Bang it up.
Well, home is where the heart is.
God, what a mess, it gives me cardiac arrest.
But my heart isn't willing to stay there.
Crawl to the bed, I can't get no rest.
My man never learned to pick up his.
Pardon the spell, you know he never does the laundry.
Dirty shirts and socks and underwear, he doesn't even care. Talking about trash,
my baby leaves his trash all over the house. I got to dig and dig and dig just to find the bathroom in the morning. My baby loves trash. My baby leaves his trash all over the house. I think it's time to trash my baby.
Bang it up. Bang it up.
Bow wow.
Bang it up. Bang it up.
Bow wow.
Bang it up. Bang it up.
Bow wow.
Bang it up.
Bang
it up.
Bow wow.
Bang it up.
Bang
it up.